Our speaker tonight is Jaya Shree, my dear friend and long time Zen student. I feel that Jaya is the embodiment of our practice, of our spiritual practice, with her warmth, generosity, her good humor, her humility, her willingness to do anything that's required without hesitation. It's good to see you in that seat tonight, Jaya. We look forward to what you have to share with us. Thank you.
Thank you for those kind words, Les. It means very much to me what you say. So let me begin. Good evening. And today's talk is motivated by an article that I read a couple of months ago, and I actually shared it with Les. And it was titled, "The Japanese Skill Copied by the Rest of the World." And it appeared online at bbc.com, and by the title, I was intrigued. Given that I teach in a business school, I immediately assumed that it focused on an innovative style of Japanese management structures. It must be an idea like the Kairetsu networks, which I was familiar with, and that has prevailed since the Meiji Restoration in the mid-1800s. My assumption was incorrect. The article is far more profound. It focuses on the practice of mindfulness, moment-to-moment awareness, or present moment awareness. And it makes the point that it is an intrinsic part of the Japanese culture. So, given my practice, I immediately assumed that it would discuss the practice of zazen, right, where we sit cross-legged on the cushion. I thought it would detail how to sit in zazen and how prevalent it was in that culture and so forth. After all, when we sit in zazen, it is a form of mindfulness, and it is a skill that we have copied and that originated in Japan. Again, much to my surprise as I read the article, my assumption was incorrect. Instead, the article actually focused or provided examples of how and why the practice of mindfulness is so deeply ingrained into the Japanese life, particularly as it related to daily activities performed. And it discussed specific activities. So, for example, it mentions the tea ceremony, which is very synonymous with our practice, with Zen practice, and how participants take time to appreciate the teacups, the room, the decorations in the rooms. It is not a ceremony involving tea, but in fact it is just tea. Just that particular moment, fully experienced, fully appreciated. The key point is that by meticulous attention to every detail, by preparing and drinking tea, the participants enter into a shared, intimate experience of tea. It then described haiku poetry, which has been strongly influenced by Zen Buddhists. Haiku poetry captures the moment's essence in just 17 syllables. It is momentary, condensed poetic form. And its special quality is that it is perfectly adapted to give that little bit of instant kensho. Kensho is also known as that little flash of enlightenment. Many of Basho's poems, a noted, well-known poet and Zen priest, have that characteristic, and some of you may have read his poems. Other activities include cherry blossom viewing or tsukimi, the autumn moon viewing festival. I'm sure many of us have experienced the heightened sense of beauty from experiences in nature that are short-lived, such as the sunrise and sunset. However, inherent in the Japanese culture is the understanding that basic reality is one of constant change or impermanence. Transience forms the Japanese sense of beauty, according to a Zen priest and well-known garden designer Shunyo Masuno. A world consisting of changes that presents itself to our senses is actually the only reality. There is no conception of stability behind it. And this was eloquently expressed in the writings and sayings of 13th century Zen master Dogen. And this understanding prevails in the Japanese culture. So when you try to understand why that is so, the underlying reasons are historical in nature. For example, during the Kamakura era in the 12th century, Zen became popular among the samurai classes, while at the same time having a deep impact on the arts and many other activities, such as the tea ceremony, flower arranging, and landscape gardening. In the 17th century, during the Edo period, Zen monks had an active role in influencing education among all social classes, not just the samurai class, by setting up libraries and publishing materials in Zen sayings and verses. 2 summers ago, I traveled to Japan in order to experience many of the Zen temples and monasteries, including our founder's temple, Rinso Inn, and Eheiji, where Dogen lived. And of course, there I noticed much of the practice. However, I also noticed countless applications of Zen and mindfulness in everyday life. Students at school begin or end the day with a ceremony. Before every class, teachers and students bow and thank each other. And before each lesson, students are asked to focus and concentrate their minds. In a work environment, so the simple act of exchanging a business card involves an important ritual called Meishi Kukan. It's actually considered a formal introduction to the person. No business can actually begin until cards are exchanged, very mindfully, with 2 hands and the card face down. And the recipient receives it and holds it very carefully giving it much importance. Because the exchange itself indicates the beginning of a relationship, hopefully a long-term relationship. In the last 2 years, I noticed one activity that became extremely popular, so popular that they even organized tours and excursions, and that of moss viewing. Moss is a green, flowerless plant. It grows in moist grounds, tree trunks, and rocks, and in most countries, including the United States, moss is considered a nuisance. Or at best, it's ignored. If you do a casual online search of moss removal, it shows a dozen different harsh chemical products that you can buy. Yet, in Japan. Most gardens, Zen gardens as we know them, are thought to be incomplete without the plant. For at least 1,000 years, Zen monks have celebrated its presence in written descriptions of temple landscapes. The Japanese national anthem even contains the word moss. One explanation lies in the Japanese concept or aesthetic of wabi-sabi, which includes qualities like impermanence, humility, asymmetry, and imperfection. An academic has actually written a paper on that. Moss grows at a very slow pace. It often perseveres despite harsh conditions, and it has a beauty despite imperfections. During my travels in Japan, I was fortunate to see one of the most famous moss gardens located just outside Kyoto at the Saihoji Temple. It has over 120 varieties of moss, of mosses. The monks at Saihoji have established a ritual that all visitors must participate in before touring the grounds. In a temple hall on small low wooden desks, visitors are asked to sit on the floor with pen and ink and trace the printed characters of a sutra. After that, and only after that, do they believe that the moss can be viewed and appreciated more deeply. Why is this so important? Moss viewing is a reminder that we often overlook and do not give even a second thought to many aspects in our daily life and, of course, in nature. We need to stop, notice, and be mindful. Here is where our challenge lies. As practitioners here in the United States, we do not have the benefit of centuries of Zen Buddhist influences. So we need to continue our practice with sincerity. However, practice of Zazen as we sit on our cushion is only one part. The other part lies in taking the attitude of Zazen to all other aspects of our life. To take what we learn on the cushion to our daily activities. To quote Suzuki Roshi, our founder, Zen is not some kind of excitement, but concentration on our usual everyday routine. In the introduction to the book Zen Keys, Philip Kaplow writes, "The truth of existence is revealed through a deepening awareness that comes from living a life of single-mindedness, of being awake in whatever one is doing. There is no better laboratory for doing this aware work than everyday life, especially one's daily work." Here's a Zen story that I particularly liked, and it's called Every Minute Zen. And it illustrates these points that were raised. And it's from Zen Flesh and Zen Bones. Zen students are with their masters for at least 10 years before they can be presumed to teach others. Nanin, a Zen master, was visited by student Tenno, who, having passed his apprenticeship, had become a teacher. The day happened to be rainy, so Tenno wore wooden clogs and carried an umbrella. After greeting him, Nanin remarked, "I suppose you left your wooden clogs in the vestibule. I want to know if your umbrella is on the right or left side of the clogs." Tenno, confused, had no instant answer. He realized that he was unable to carry his Zen every minute. He became Nanin's pupil, and he studied 6 more years to accomplish his every minute Zen. So, given that we understand the importance of our extending our practice to our daily life and activities. The question arises, what is the best way? In preparing for this talk, I tried to find the answers by seeking out other practitioners and books and summarizing the experiences. The insights are certainly helpful, and they coalesce around the ideas such as doing one task at a time, being slow and deliberate, taking time, being totally concentrated, doing less, developing rituals, simplifying, establishing a routine. While these are all useful, I actually found the answer in a story also coming from Zen Keys, written by Thich Nhat Hanh. So the story goes, one day a monk asked a famous Zen master, Chao Chu, to speak to him about Zen, to explain to him the ideas of Zen. Chao Chu turned to the monk and asked, "Have you finished your breakfast?" The monk replied, "Yes, master, I have eaten my breakfast." Master Chao Chu responded, "Then go and wash the bowl." Go and wash the bowl. This is also go and live with Zen. Instead of giving the questioner, the monk, explanations about Zen, the master opened the door and invited the man to enter directly into the world of reality, the reality of Zen. As Thich Nhat Hanh explains, these words contain no secret meaning to explore and explain. It is very simple, direct, and clear declaration. So in our practice, each of us needs to find that go and wash the bowl experience. In my case, over the years, I've come to realize that there have been many activities, from daily lighting candles and incense at my altar, teaching my children to watch the clouds instead of moon watching or moon viewing, cloud viewing, observing trees in nature. Although I can say the most important has been Saturday mornings at Kanendo. After morning zazen on Saturdays and service, we eat breakfast. Each person may bring an item to share, then we eat mindfully and with care, making sure that everyone's plate is served in case they're busy pouring tea or engaged in another activity. After that, there's an hour's work period where everyone volunteers to do some cleaning activity, whether it be the zendo here, the sangha house, the kitchen, or the bathrooms. It has been inspiring for me to observe sangha members perform their activities slowly, deliberately, and completely. Just as Suzuki Roshi recommended, when you do something, you should burn yourself up completely, like a good bonfire, leaving no trace of yourself. Everyone displays that attitude. It is also inspiring to see Les on his knees as he cleans the zendo floors. And of course, sometimes that does bring me some worry. In a monastery, aside from zazen, cooking and cleaning are two of the most important parts of a monk's day. They are another way to practice mindfulness. It is relevant to note that often, myself included, we discriminate among these activities. I must acknowledge that for the longest time, I had convinced myself that I was taking the practice into my daily life, as I was always so mindful and sincere in my professional life. When I sat down to work, I was focused, aware, slow, deliberate, and no thoughts distracting me. However, as is pointed out in Zen Keys, There is more to consider. All labor and all activities is viewed with the eye of equality, for it is nothing but the workings of a dualistic mind that discriminates between agreeable and disagreeable jobs, between creative and uncreative work. It is to root out this weighing and judging that Zen novices in monasteries are set to work pulling weeds by hands, licking envelopes, or doing other seemingly unimportant, non-creative work at the start of their training. And I saw this up close when I visited Aheiji. To conclude, in the midst of the world around us, each of us has a responsibility to find activities that will enable us to engage in our practice. Perhaps that go wash that bowl moment, so that eventually each moment becomes our practice. To quote Kaplow, who wrote the introduction to Zen Keats, "For what else is there but the pure act, the lifting of the hammer, the washing of the dish, the movement of the hands on the machine, or the pulling of the wheat?" Take any questions that you might have.
You said to go out and find a task to do, and I'm thinking, turn that back around, and tasks will find one that one should be doing, and to be open for that, that activity.
And I don't want to get caught up in the words, but I think when I use the word activity or task, perhaps experience would be a better choice. So find the experience, and I'm in totally agreement with that. Absolutely, find the experience. So when my children were little, I would tell them, look at the clouds, to get them to experience the clouds so that they might be mindful of whatever they were doing. So yeah.
Probably a terrible thing to bring up, but I was reading in a business magazine today, perhaps, that Oculus virtual reality headset has been disappointing. It's only sold about 1.2 million units or something so far. But that the virtual reality industry still has big hopes for it, and it's going to depend on the types of experiences that are created for it, and I really don't know what my point is there, other than I guess it's, I'll pose it as a cone, you know, that it's kind of paradoxical to think about the potential virtual nature of our world. It kind of, I guess, in one sense emphasizes even more so what we may be drifting away from if we allow ourselves, you know, from the immediate moment.
Could you give us some perhaps more specific examples of how you bring the Zen practice into your daily work? You mentioned something in your talk, but if you could give something more specific.
Good question. So I think the most, that has actually been, for me personally, the easiest part. Bringing the practice of being present in every moment into my work. I'm passionate about my work, and I find that if I'm passionate about something, then I'm extremely present. So I really don't have to work very hard, and I don't know what your own experiences are, but if you're in, on a project and you're working in it and you're really enjoying it, you find that automatically your mind is very in tuned to that particular activity. It's when, so there have been times when I'm doing something that I really don't enjoy, that has been thrust on me. Those are the more challenging moments. And what I do, it's tough, but I settle myself. I sit, I literally just sit for and sit on it and let it just be there with me and accept, and in a way accept that, come to a terms of acceptance. And so just sitting zazen on my desk, so to speak. So today I found out that I was supposed to have 68 students in my MBA class, and I saw some correspondence between the copy center and the person in charge of the program that said, well, make 75 copies just in case. This is shocking to me. So what do I do? I could have just picked up the phone or sent an email, but I just sat, focused on my breath, and have not reacted. And eventually, after I sit for a bit, something is going to clear up as to whether I do or do not need to take action. So I think the difficult moments I've done by just sitting in zazen at that point in time and then letting that moment pass. That helps.
If I look at a history of humankind, the need for intoxicants and the practice of creating them and distributing them seems to have played an important role too, and in essence it's a counterpoint, it's a counterbalancing point, it's a mindless state. And often it plays a role for people who have to endure, or it's either a self-medication or a prescribed medication, especially in the modern world. And I'm wondering if there's space for that as well, where in a practice, and I think Japanese culture seems to have it, because it seems to practice drinking often to the extreme. And I'm wondering how you, like, whether you're resolving that in your own life as well, the balance between a fully mindful state turned on at all times versus the need for tuning out.
I think the reality is whether you take medications or you take drugs or whatever intoxicants, the reality is we all need to tune out at some point. I don't think that any of us are capable, at least I don't know if anyone, maybe less, but I don't know too many people that can stay completely mindful and aware at all times. We face many, at least I have faced many challenges in my life, although I haven't turned to any artificial means of being in a mindless state. I've certainly used other means. I've turned on music, to blank myself out. I, you know, walked too much because I've been so miserable. Which is, to me, is whether you take an intoxicant or whether you do something in excess like that to blank out the pain that you might be feeling is no different. So I think even if you do or don't take an intoxicant, I think the point is that learning to accept that there are going to be those periods in your life and accepting them and then coming back. And being able to come back. That's the challenge. So.
Still does, but mostly it's just more noise. Let it go. Anyway, thanks for your talk.
So, in my professional life, as I said, I find it a lot easier to put my practice to work because I enjoy it and I have passion for it. In my personal life, it's far more challenging. And I think there's a lot of things you have to deal with in your personal life that make it a little more difficult to stay in that moment. There are things that pull at you, things that distract you, things that... So I try, and it's very difficult, and extremely difficult at times, to stay present and stay in that moment. But, and I... Actually, Les has given me this advice, which I really appreciated. I was making a trip to visit my family overseas, and I was very anxious about it. And a lot of ego was involved, a lot of issues when you visit family. And he told me, just sit back. Don't say too much, just listen. So what I find myself doing more and more is listening and not saying as much. Observing the moment when you're with people seems to somehow make it a bit easier to stay in the moment and do, and then do what is right for that moment. So I try to use that practice of listening when I'm with people much more.